This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is on holiday, and this is a special holiday edition. We're bringing back some very notable interviews with two scholars who've documented the critical role blacks played in the American War of Independence. For the most part, blacks fought on the side of the British. But first, six members of Congress sent a letter to President Obama urging him not to send troops or otherwise engage in hostilities with Syria without the express authorization of the Congress. The effort to head off yet another undeclared war is spearheaded by North Carolina Republican Walter Jones. Only two of the congressmen that signed the letter were Democrats, and only one of them, Charles Rangel of New York, is black. Rangel spoke at a press conference called by Congressman Jones in Washington.
Well, I thank you for relieving some of the guilt that we as members of Congress should have, knowing that day after day, week after week, your moral voice will be heard makes it difficult for a lot of us, because we're here to uphold the Constitution. There are no courses in school and universities that allow any president to send our young men and women off into harm's way without coming to the Congress. Now, that's the way it is, and that's the way it has been, and yet we have so many tens of thousands of families that have lost their loved ones since World War II. And it's actually reached the point that presidents just don't give a darn about the Congress. That may not be too bad, but how do we go to the funerals of our constituents? What do you say when you look in the casket and see a young man and a young woman, and the family clings to you because you're a symbol of the United States government, and they want so badly to hear that their son or their daughter was a patriot, was a hero? And you know, once that flag goes up, of course you are a hero. But how do you answer the question as to why they were there? Why were they there? And that's the painful stain that we have on our history. Now, it's very simple. I am just as patriotic as the next guy. And when someone says that our nation is in trouble, that our national security is threatened, the way I look at it, it's time to call up our troops and have a draft. That's the way I look at it. And if you cannot find in your heart to ask every American to step forward and make some sacrifice, then we should not be involved in it. It means clearly it's not in our national security. I challenge anybody to come to this country, enjoy all of its benefits, and then we get into trouble. And you say, hey, I'm with the United States of America, but don't ask for an increase in taxes. And don't put my son or grandson in jeopardy. And for God's sake, don't put me in jeopardy. That is wrong, and that is un-American. So what is my colleague saying? Don't go off and fight wars? He doesn't even say don't go off and fight wars for oil. He just says if it's important enough to go to war, come to the Congress. And you know what that means? It means come to the American people. Is that asking too much? to say before anyone gets hurt, wounded, or dies, that we ask our people back home, do you think it's worth it? And so let me thank you and your dad and everyone for coming out. It's remarkable, the small number of people. I couldn't even find this room. I honestly, when I saw Cannon, I thought it was in 345, the big room. And if sending men and women off to combat is this important, then I end up in saying, where are the ministers? Where are the rabbis? Where are the imams? Because I hear their voices with same-sex marriages. Oh, that's a terrible thing. Oh, world's going to come to an end. I hear their voices with men who like men and women who like women, and that's going to break up marriage in the United States, what's left of it. And I know they bless guns wherever the guns go. And I know the chaplains, they carry guns too, just in case some of the enemy gets in God's work way, you shoot them. But on this issue, human beings that are born, I would like to believe that they would think it's outrageous, immoral, unconstitutional.
That was New York Black Congressman Charles Rangel. Also on hand was Patrick Lang, a retired lieutenant colonel and former head of Defense Intelligence Agency operations in the Middle East and North Africa. He says the U.S. is behaving towards Syria in much the same way as it did towards Iraq just before the 2003 invasion.
I spoke at a town meeting gathering in Lexington, Virginia, in the late part of 2002. That's where my alma mater is located. And I told people in the audience that if you're not paying attention, perhaps you don't know that the train has already left the station, that we are already on our way to war in Iraq. And a number of people still remember my saying that. They thought it was a strange thing for me to say at the time, but it turned out to be correct. Well, in my opinion, this is late 2002 again. It has come again to us. Because you can look across the spectrum of think tank generated opinion at various meetings in Washington, which I often sometimes are invited to, or the general tenor of stuff in the mainstream media, and it all kind of says the kind of thing that was being said in late 2002. There's a great deal of exaggeration going on, but a couple of things need to be pointed out about this. One is that in contradiction to what is being said in all this propaganda, in fact, the outcome in Syria is not at all certain. If you read foreign newspapers, you might have seen in the British newspaper The Independent a few days ago an article by a man named Cockburn who wrote from Damascus about what actual conditions are like on the ground in Syria based on having been there 2 weeks. He said that he got in a car and drove 100 miles north to the city of Homs without any interference, whatever, didn't see anything of the war going on, talked to people in and around this city, which has in the past been a hotbed of Sunni activism, and came to the conclusion that the picture being painted in the West of how close the Assad government is to falling is grossly exaggerated. And this is an extremely significant fact. The other thing is the government of the United States is clearly embarked on a course which, if followed, will lead to military intervention in Syria. How can I tell that? Well, it is our stated policy that regime change is the desired policy of the United States. That's been established for some time now. Recently, we recognized the various groups of the Syrian opposition as being the official government of Syria. Based on that kind of a proceeding, even though there's no UN action on this that I can think of at the moment, it would be possible for that government to ask for our intervention, and we could claim that it is a legitimate action. The next thing about this that is interesting is that among the coalition of groups that are fighting the Assad government is one called Jabhat al-Nusra, and this is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda worldwide, the very essence of our enemy spread across the world, projected into Syria. They're amongst the leading fighters against the Assad government. The United States has condemned this group as a foreign enemy. But in spite of that, the leaders of the rest of the guerrillas fighting Assad have come forth across the world to demand that we rescind that condemnation of al-Nusra because they are, in fact, their friends. So the other thing that is clear here that if the Assad government falls, we have no idea really at all what kind of government would succeed at all. When you consider all of this put together, you have to ask yourself why these two gentlemen from the House of Representatives are not completely correct. Especially in a situation in which the outcome is uncertain, and what the successor regime might be, and how inimical to our interests it might be, why on earth would the government not go to the Congress for approval for the appointment of U.S. forces? And as things are going now, it seems inevitable to me that if we continue on this path, the U.S. government will feel that rather than be defeated in its policy at this point, it will have to use military force, which would probably take the form of air intervention, a no-fly zone, direct resupply to the rebel groups, things of that kind. I don't think that after what has happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're likely to try to occupy Syria with a coin campaign. That has proven to be a not very fruitful enterprise.
That was Patrick Lang, former head of Defense Intelligence Agency operations in the Middle East and North Africa. The next two interviews were conducted during the past year, and we're re-gifting them to you for the holidays. Our guests are both authors of books on black participation in the American War of Independence. Dr. Gerald Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. His latest book is titled Negroes of the Crown, in which he contends that the American Revolution was actually a white settler rebellion to perpetuate slavery. Most black slaves were acutely aware of that fact and favored the British side in the war.
There are different trends that take place in the writing of history. That is to say, even though the basic facts may not change, but our interpretations change. And our interpretations oftentimes change because the needs of different generations change. Look at W.E.B. Du Bois and his book on Black Reconstruction, which upended the then reigning interpretation of that period following the U.S. Civil War, i.e. 1865-1876, and which theretofore had been seen as an era of Negro corruption and misdeeds and all the rest, and Du Bois put it in the exact opposite way. And I think that we're well overdue for a reinterpretation of the history of the United States because a lot of the basic narrative really doesn't make any sense. What I mean is, if this was such a grand revolution as it has been taught to us, even by our so-called progressive historians, then how did it end up so badly as a Leviathan? Why did conditions for the enslaved population actually worsen after the rebels defeated the British? Why did it take until 1965 for basic voting rights to be validated after the so-called Grand Revolution? And I think as well because of the rise of China, which I think is going to shake the psyche and the confidence of the U.S. elite, and I might also say the U.S. population as a whole, there's going to be a groping for a new interpretation that fits the current conditions. And I think this is where my book comes in. Because basically what I say in this book is that the revolt against British rule was basically a successful revolt of racist settlers. That is to say that it was akin to Rhodesia in 1965, assuming that Ian Smith and his cabal had triumphed. It was akin to the revolt of the French settlers in Algeria, North Africa, in the 1950s and the 1960s, assuming that those French settlers had triumphed. And just as it would have been difficult for Rhodesia or French Algeria to construct a progressive republic after a racist revolt, it was very difficult to construct a progressive republic in North America after what was basically a racist revolt. Now, the book at hand, of course, deals with a number of episodes where I show that the Africans were basically not on board with the revolt against British rule, not least because the revolt in British rule, against British rule, was motivated in no small part by the fact that abolitionism was growing in London and was thought in North America to be on course to spread to the entire British Empire. This is one of the many reasons why you had more Africans by an order of magnitude who fought against the rebels in 1776 than fought alongside the rebels. And this is why the War of 1812, whose bicentennial will be marked within a few weeks, that is to say in 2012, the War of 1812 was probably witnessed the longest and most sustained period of unrest by enslaved Africans in the history of the United States, even though this may come as a surprise to many people who study history for a living. You may recall that it was in August 1814 that the Redcoats took the torch to Washington, D.C. You may not know that there were Negroes and Redcoats who were present in great numbers. You may know that one of the reasons why Washington, that is to say the United States, had such difficulty in defeating the British in that war was because they always had to worry about their backside. That is to say, if they sent their so-called white troops out to confront the British, they had to worry as to whether or not the enslaved Africans would then seize the opportunity to revolt, which is basically what happened in Virginia, in Georgia, etc.
And yet, what we know in terms of black folks and the War of 1812 is the story of those colored troops, that's the way they call themselves, who fought with Andrew Jackson in the Battle of New Orleans.
That's true, and that is a fact, and I have quite a bit of new evidence with regard to that. It's very curious. One of the most sustained and violent episodes of slave unrest took place in 1811 in Louisiana. In fact, Louisiana as a state probably has the broadest and deepest history of revolt against slavery by black folk than any other state in the so-called Union. And this slave revolt of 1811 was basically squashed, not least because of the assistance, I'm afraid, of so-called colored troops and militia who were enlisted on the part of the authorities. And the Battle of New Orleans, basically erupting at the end of 1814 and the beginning of 1815, not only saw the use of these colored troops on behalf of the Stars and Stripes, but also you should know that about maybe 10 to 15% of those fighting under the Union Jack, that is to say fighting with the British troops, were of African descent, mostly Jamaicans. Because you need to know that Africans in the hemisphere, and perhaps even worldwide, looked at the United States the way that we looked at apartheid South Africa in the 20th century. That is to say, it was like a holy crusade to oppose the United States of America by Africans worldwide, and particularly by those in the Caribbean. I talk in the book about a number of episodes where the slave masters of Virginia in particular were seeking to transport enslaved Africans to the newer territories, such as in Mississippi, for example, in the first few decades of the 20th century. You may know that Virginia, by the first few decades of the 19th century, it had basically become something of a breeding state, and I mean what I say there. That is to say, it was basically breeding Africans for export. And so what was happening is that they were trying to transport these Africans to Mississippi in particular. The problem was, how did you get those Africans to Mississippi? If you went overland, you had to face the prospect of rebellious indigenous people who did not necessarily cotton to the idea of these Euro-Americans traipsing across their territory. So they were trying to do it by ship. But what happened is that sometimes the ships would be blown into Bermuda, for example, which is only a few hundred miles off the coast of the United States. And so what would happen is that the British, and particularly the Africans in Bermuda, would then clamor for these Africans to be free. Now, let's back up for a second and acknowledge that Britain in its colonies was a slave-owning power, but abolitionism sunk deeper roots in the British Empire than in the Republic, not least because this Republic, that is the United States of America, was basically born as a settlers revolt in order to perpetuate slavery because they were afraid of the import and impact of abolitionism, particularly Somerset's case, which comes in June 1772 in London, which seems to suggest that abolitionism is going to be spreading across the entire import. And, of course, Somerset's case helps to light the fuse for 1776. I should also say that by the first few decades of the 19th century, the British were coming to rely very heavily upon African labor. And they were then worried that the European settlers would do a replay of 1776. And, of course, that was in the minds of these European settlers in Bermuda, for example, and in Nassau and the Bahamas, too, for that matter. So London was beginning to sideline and marginalize the European settlers in these colonies, which is why some of them then migrated to the United States. St. George Tucker, for example, who was a leading figure in Virginia in the early 19th century, particularly with regard to Gabriel's Revolt in Richmond in about 1800 in Virginia, was from Bermuda, as were a number of other leading figures. And so when these boats, these slave ships, would then be blown off course to Bermuda, the Africans would clamor for their release, and then Britain, which still had a bone to pick with the United States because they were still smarting from the revolt against British rule, and then the hubristic statements by the Republicans, that is, say, the U.S. nationals, that they had discovered the secret to humanity and the secret to happiness by overthrowing British rule, this was a way to stick it to the United States. And this was a way to basically stir up controversy in the United States. And so they would oftentimes free these Africans, and this happened repeatedly. And so this was also helping to carry the favor of the enslaved Africans on North American soil. It's a well-known diplomatic tactic to carry favor with the dissidents of your opponent. I mean, for example, it's no secret, for example, that the United States got quite a bit of traction during the Cold War by appealing to those in the Soviet Union who had a bone to pick with Moscow. For example, these large campaigns on behalf of Soviet Jewry, which of course led to a major migration to Israel from Russia and helping to bolster, I'm afraid, the right-wing population of Israel. So London was attempting the same sort of maneuver by currying favor with these enslaved Africans in the states of the United States of America.
So as you explained it, Frederick Douglass's rebuke to the United States with his famous 4th of July address was actually speaking for the African diaspora, and his trips to Britain for fundraising and for agitation are certainly in context with this.
Not only that, but you need to realize, now buckle your seatbelts, Mr. Ford, and also a listening audience. The Africans did not see the revolt against British rule and the establishment of the United States as legitimate. Just as you have numerous Cuban Americans in Florida and in New York who did not see the revolution in 1959 as legitimate, which is why they don't see why the United States should recognize the state, well, Africans felt the same way about the United States of America. Now, let me step back for a second and put this in even a broader context. Another reason for the help shed light on what I'm talking about is the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804. The Haitian Revolution basically upset the calculus with regard to slavery, as I note in the book, and basically induces a general crisis of the slave system that can only be resolved with its collapse, which happens in the United States 1861, 1865 with the U.S. Civil War, and 1888 with the final collapse of slavery in Brazil. What I mean by that is that 1791 to 1804, particularly the early years of the revolt against French rule in Haiti, you saw many of the major powers, including London, they sought to intervene against the Africans in Haiti. And London suffered one of the most ignominious defeats in its long history with its intervention against the Africans in Haiti. And after suffering that defeat, the Londoners, the elite of the British Empire, stepped back for a second, and they recognized that the jig was up with regard to slavery, not least because Haiti was quite close to Jamaica, one of the crown jewels of the British Empire, and that, like successful revolutionaries anywhere, the Haitians would try to spread their seditious message, not least in their own neighborhood. And so I quote at length from Londoner saying, wait a minute, the jig is up, it's time to reconfigure. You can draw a straight line from the Haitian Revolution to London moving to abolish slavery in the empire approximately three decades later. But the United States of America did not, perhaps at that moment, could not draw that conclusion, not least because they were born as a revolt against abolitionism, not least because, as noted, the most powerful state in the Union was Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's Virginia, and not least because a great deal, a disproportionate amount of the capital in the United States was embodied in the bodies of Africans. And so as London then accelerated its path towards abolitionism with the Haitian Revolution, the United States dug in its heels. And then that led basically to collaborations between Port-au-Prince, that is to say Haiti, and Britain against the United States on many different levels, which I detail in the book. So the Haitian Revolution, it seems to me, as has been noted by many writers and analysts previously, was quite a boon to the abolitionist movement in the United States, which is why we still owe a major debt of gratitude to Haiti.
How much are the white settler revolt origins of the United States reflected in U.S. imperial policy today?
Oh, it's reflected all across the board. I mean, first of all, you have this idea, this mythology, which still is taught in universities, I'm afraid, of isolationism, of the Republic and the Monroe Doctrine proclaimed by President James Monroe approximately 190 years ago, supposedly reflects this so-called isolationism. But actually, this isolationism had many different strands. First of all, the United States was basically consolidating its rule in North America, fighting indigenous nations, that's to say Native American nations, and therefore it wanted the Londoners to butt out, because there's another story to be told, and it has been told to a certain degree, about how the Native Americans as well were collaborating with London against Washington. And I tell this story as it manifests itself in Florida, where you have some of the bloodiest wars the United States has been involved in its bloody history, the so-called Seminole Wars, three Seminole Wars, in fact, 1818, 1819, 1830s, and the 1850s, where you basically had Africans and indigenous people combining as one against the extension of Washington's rule in what is now the Sunshine State. Sadly, as we know, that did not work itself out. So, yes, it's very important to point out that this whole idea of isolationism was not only a way to allow Washington to continue its routing of Native American peoples, but also to keep London and other powers from interfering on behalf of Africans and on behalf of Native Americans. Because keep in mind that there's substantial contestation for North America. Somehow now, I guess we sort of see after the fact, sadly enough, that it was inevitable. It was far from inevitable. I mean, for example, Russia was involved on the West Coast. You know that the United States buys Alaska from Russia, 1867, Seward's Folly, it was called at the time, after Secretary of State William Seward, but actually, as is now recognized, it was really a steal, not to mention a travesty in terms of the rights of the indigenous people of Alaska. But even California, there was major contestation for California in the 1840s and 1850s, not only between the United States and Mexico, but also Russia and Britain. Indeed, one of the things I point out when I get to California history, after the defeat of Mexico in that war of aggression, 1846 to 1848, and then the discovery of gold in Northern California, the area around Sacramento, California, is that you had a major influx into Northern California from Australia, because it, in some ways, it was easier to get to California from Australia than to get to California from New York. I mean, you could just take a ship, straight shot from Sydney, whereas from New York, you'd have to fight Native Americans every step of the way. You have these Australians flooding in. They're being lynched by the Euro-Americans because they see them, correctly so, as stalking horses for London. Because there's a so-called special relationship between Britain and the United States today, people read that back, which is oftentimes what historians and, of course, non-historians do. But, of course, Britain in the mid-19th century was like the Al-Qaeda of today, in other words. It was a hated country, except by the Africans, who, of course, tended to be pro-London because they saw London as a standard bearer for abolitionism. So in any case, you also have the Negroes being lynched in Northern California. So what happens? Sir James Douglas, who is a man of color, who is the governor of what is now British Columbia, and indeed the founding father of British Columbia. One of the interesting aspects of this book, I think, is that because Britain had this far-flung empire and had a relatively small population, it had to rely more on Negroes to be administrators. I mean, you hardly have black governors today in the United States. I mean, Deval Patrick and who else, for example. But in British Columbia in the mid-19th century, you had Sir James Douglas. He makes an appeal to the Negroes of San Francisco to move northward, where he says you can vote. And in fact, the cover of this book is a picture of the Negroes from San Francisco who move to what is now British Columbia after the appeal of Sir James Douglas and take up arms on behalf of Britain and the British Empire, because, of course, Canada was part of the British Empire, at a time when relations between the British Empire and Washington were, of course, in its usual bad state. One of the larger takeaways, I think, that a reader should note from this book is that the dirty secret, as I put it, of the progress of people of African descent in the United States of America has been that we have made progress to the extent we have been able to stiff-arm and ignore U.S. sovereignty. Parenthetically, that's one of the reasons, I think, that our friends on the left missed the boat with the Battle of Seattle 1999, the anti-world Trade Organization protest, where part of the cry of some was that they felt the World Trade Organization was somehow detracting from U.S. sovereignty. As I said at the time, I'd rather take my chances any day. If I only have two choices, I'll take my chances with a faceless bureaucrat in Geneva any day than a faceless bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. I mean, that's been the lesson of our history. So that line about protecting U.S. sovereignty obviously needs to go into the trash heap of history. I mean, it's ludicrous.
And we can see a straight line from that attitude towards the United States and its claims as a nation being antithetical to black claims to humanity, a line straight to Malcolm X advocating that black folks in the United States treat the United States government as one would a foreign oppressor and bring it to the United Nations.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, there have been many episodes, fortunately, in the 20th century, trying to take the United States to the United Nations. This is why this book, I think, is probably going to get a better reception. As a matter of fact, it already is getting a better reception in Canada and London and Australia than in the United States, where I think it'll either be trashed or ignored, quite frankly. It's because it goes against some of the mythology. It goes against the creation myth of the United States, that it's born in this grand revolution. But also some of our friends on the left, I think, perhaps understandably, they painted this picture where they see themselves in many ways as, say, standing in the footsteps of Thomas Jefferson. You might recall the Jefferson School of Social Science of the 1950s, which was started by the Communist Party, where Lorraine Hansberry, the great playwright, basically received their political education, for example, named after Thomas Jefferson. And I think that many people on the left, they feel that they're marginal already. And so then to go against the creation myth of the United States will make them doubly and triply marginal.
And would this include Howard Zinn?
Howard Zinn, bless his soul. I respected Howard Zinn, and I think he did great work. And he's now sadly passed away, and I've tried to avoid saying anything that doesn't smile upon him, not least because he's not here to defend himself. But having said that, I have to accept the premise of your question. I mean, I think it sort of overstates the case. I mean, you get the idea that John Brown, the great Euro-American anti-slavery crusader who gave his life to help to free the enslaved, was sort of the rule. He was a distinct exception. But not only that, John Brown, as I point out in the book, basically he went to Europe, in fact to Britain, to confer with abolitionists before coming back to Harper's Ferry. A lot of the planning for Harper's Ferry, 1859, was done in Canada, which then became a target for the Confederate States of America during the U.S. Civil War of 1861-1865. Not only that, but I point to other Euro-Canadians, in fact, who in some ways outstripped Harriet Tubman, the great black woman rescuer of the enslaved, in terms of going into the South and rescuing slaves and bringing them back to Canada, for example. This is part of this conflict between the British Empire and the United States. And so, obviously, what I'm saying, I'm sure our friends on the left will not find it useful to their present struggles, but like the United States always tells other people, like they told the people in the Balkans in the 1990s, you know, you need to face your history. As bitter and as painful as it might be, you need to face it. Well, that's what I'm saying to these people of the United States of America. You need to face your history. Particularly, it's going to have to be faced because, as I said, this rise of China and the rise of Brazil and the rise of India is really going to cause a major psychic crisis in the United States. And so the better we face our history and get the true realities out, the more ahead of the curve we'll be.
Dr. Gerald Horn, the full title of his book is Negroes of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. Alan Gilbert is author of the book Black Patriots and Loyalists, Fighting for Emancipation in the War for Independence. Gilbert has a somewhat different view of blacks in the American Revolutionary War. He acknowledges that the slaves generally favored a British victory, since England promised freedom and the white settlers did not. But Gilbert says that those blacks that did side with the settlers were among the best and most experienced soldiers that George Washington had.
My book actually transforms this issue, and here's why. At the Battle of Yorktown, the decisive battle of the Revolution in which the British were defeated, a German private, Georg Daniel Flohr, who fought with the French, Rochambeau, on the side of the Americans, walked around the field of battle afterwards. And he said, most of the corpses lying around the field on both sides, that is, both Loyalists and Patriots, were Moors, blacks. Now, the way this subject has been discussed is as follows. After the history of this was whited out, so it's the white American Revolution for Independence, black abolitionists in the North and others, abolitionists, celebrated Crispus Attucks as a great martyr of the Revolution and who led the early fighting against British tyranny. But then again, it was whited out in the long racism of Jim Crow. And what happened is that the DAR had a completely white view of the Revolution, and this led to their barring Marian Anderson from singing in 1939 in protests. And so it was a victory for anti-racists if it got noticed that Crispus Attucks and a few others were there. And even so great an historian as Gary Nash writes a book in 2006 about black participation in the Revolution, which is called The Forgotten Fifth. So the way they see it is a kind of identity politics in which blacks make up a fairly small percentage of those who fought. And what happened is that the Times reporter, Neer, asked the DAR historian, who's lowballed the figures all the way through, and he said 5,000, which is conventionally said by American historians, but it's just a figure repeated from the pre-Civil War abolitionist William Mell, and never checked. And 5,000 out of 400,000 doesn't sound very significant. Okay, so go back to what I just said. They were the crucial fighters of Yorktown. The crucial fighters. Yes, many of the commanders of American forces were slaveholders. But two things had happened. One, they couldn't recruit any white people to fight. White people would join the militias for 10 months and then say, see you later. So Washington had to wage his surprise victory at Trenton on Christmas. The British couldn't imagine they'd be fighting on Christmas, because he had to give up these forces, you know, shortly thereafter. So in Rhode Island, they weren't getting any troops, and Rhode Island was a leftist state. And in Rhode Island, the governor and one of the generals suggested that they recruit blacks. So they recruited the 1st Rhode Island Regiment, which was entirely made up of blacks and Narragansett Indians. And the total number of people who fought in Rhode Island was probably blacks and Native Americans is probably around 657. That's by an independent black historian who's worked very hard on the issue, and my suspicion is that he's basically right about it. This force fought throughout the war. Their freedom was paid for by the state of Rhode Island. Every member of the Rhode Island Regiment was free. In Connecticut, they formed a black regiment. In Boston, they formed a regiment called the Bucks of Massachusetts, which probably fought at Yorktown, and of which there aren't records. So that, except for a couple of indications, a flag given by John Hancock to the regiment and various other things, there aren't a lot of numbers that it's easy to associate with them. So what happened at Yorktown was the following. One of the commanders of the 1st Rhode Island Regiment was a fellow named Olney, Stephen Olney. And when Washington had to get his best troops to take the British redoubt, the two British strongholds, he got the black troops. They were the most experienced fighters, as his aide, Baron von Clausen, said. 25% of the total American forces in Yorktown, 6,000 forces, 1,500 blacks. They were the best under arms, the best in maneuvers, the most cheerful, the most willing to fight. They were fighting for freedom, they thought. And they had the experience. And so they went off to battle. So Olney said, Washington said to them, act the part of brave soldiers. And they fixed bayonets and walked off in silence. And Olney said, I imagined that His Excellency's knee shook, but perhaps it was mine. I thought with the soldiers that with 15 minutes walk, they must think the journey of life will end with them. And then they listened and listened and listened, and shots rang out, and that wasn't good. But the black soldiers carried the day under the leadership of John Lawrence, who was an abolitionist, though a slaveholder. His family was slaveholder. And Alexander Hamilton. So the reason that there's this big fight on the American side, just to spell it out, is this. There's a second revolution, which is in many ways more important than the first. The first revolution is for independence, and that's the one everybody talks about. The second revolution was against slavery and began with 30 slave revolts between 1750 and 1770 in the Caribbean. Everywhere there were uprisings against slavery. And the sailors who had been seized by press gangs, white as well as black, and who identified their condition, you know, you're walking along the street and they come and grab you, and then, you know, climb the mast, and if you fall off, it's your tough luck. Seems like it's pretty close to slavery. They were abolitionists, and these are the people who led a lot of the revolutionary crowds, including the Boston Tea Party. There were also Christian abolitionists started by the Quakers who mostly didn't fight. But all the other Christians, a lot of them came in on this. So Samuel Hopkins said, slavery is a sin of crimson dye, and blamed every defeat of the patriots on their holding slaves. And he said, the only way, in 1775, the only way that we're going to win this revolution against the British recruiting blacks and using them against us is to free all the blacks ourselves. We don't even have to recruit them to fight, we just have to free them. So there was this very large movement from below, which tremendously affected the consciousness of the American Revolution. And the best thing that happened in the Revolution in 1779, the Continental Congress passed a bill saying that Georgia and South Carolina should recruit 2,000 black slaves and free them in Georgia and 3,000 in South Carolina in exchange for fighting. And this is called the Lorenz proposal for John Lawrence, who fought for it. He was an aide to George Washington. And Washington went along with it, even though it would have meant gradual emancipation in the South after the Revolution. And it was defeated only by the legislatures in South Carolina and Georgia. The slave owners there would rather submit to the British than mobilize blacks to fight for freedom. They were not freedom fighters.
Isn't there a danger, Mr. Gilbert, in combating the white out of black participation on the independent side in that war, that you're exaggerating the impact of blacks on the independent side? For example, at Yorktown, the best fighters and a quarter of those fighters, as you say, were black, but that represented only 1,500 troops. I've heard estimates in terms of black participation on the Loyalist or British side of 100,000.
Yes, and actually there are estimates from 20,000, which is the lowball estimate, to 100,000. And I provide serious figures and go over every list. So one of the ways in which I protect myself against exaggeration, is that I do numbers much more than historians do. And what I claim is based on actually going over lists and breaking down statistics. So you can see in the book how I do that. But there's no doubt that the reason this hasn't been discussed on the American side, and even black abolitionists during the run-up to the Civil War didn't discuss it, is that the dirty secret of the American Revolution is that Governor Dunmore of Virginia, starting in 1772, threatened to free all the blacks and indentured servants who would come to the British side, and he said to the rebellious and, he thought, proud slave-owning colonists, "I will free them all if you do this, and I will raise your mansions to the ground." So, naturally, lots of blacks thought that the crown represented freedom. And at the same time, as Dunmore was making these threats, there was a decision in Britain of the British High Court, the Mansfield decision, which freed slaves on British soil, or at least the slave James Somerset. And was interpreted widely and by blacks as freeing slaves on British soil. So that England was no longer seen as a home for bondage. And the slave owners, therefore, rebelled in a parallel to a secession, parallel to the Civil War, that is, in the South. The whole South rebelled to preserve slavery, primarily. Virginia had a few other reasons. South Carolina probably only joined the colonies, the independence movement to preserve slavery.
And, of course, so, that's where the great majority of black folks were, in those slave colonies that wanted to become states.
Yes and no. Just a qualification. Yes, they were mostly in South Carolina and to a great extent Virginia. But there was many slaves in New York at the time. And New York actually had declared gradual emancipation in 1799, and there's a complicated history. But actually, one of the things I do is look at the American Revolution in the context of independence movements of black and brown people throughout the hemisphere. So Haiti was made independent and created by the slaves of Saint-Domingue who rose up, starting in 1791, and they made Haiti in 1804. So independence was abolition. In Venezuela, Bolivar was losing to Spain and went to Republican Haiti and got support in exchange for gradual emancipation. So emancipation and independence went together. They still committed genocide against indigenous people. They weren't wonderful. But if you compare America, North America, to the revolutions to the South of black and brown people, it's utterly startling that in the first new nation, there was gradual emancipation only in the North, and there was a civil war 84 et cetera, years later over the issue of bondage. It's the only place.
And, of course, we are aware of a large black population in New York City. 30% of New York City was black at one time, and New York City experienced a slave revolt. But these were still small numbers compared to the great bulk of the black population being in what then came to be known as the slave states. All of the United States were slave states at one point, as you've pointed out. But
yes,
in that same Yorktown, after that battle in which you point out the importance of the 1500 black soldiers fighting for Washington, we also know that Washington's troops lined up on the shore as the British were leaving and were taking with them, against the wishes of the Americans on the shore, the white Americans, thousands of black soldiers who had fought with the British and their families.
Well, the British did take with them lots of blacks, but not from Yorktown. And they did manage to take some of the black soldiers who had fought for them. But the bulk of blacks who went with the British, there were a huge number who were recruited by the British and did all sorts of work for the British. They did all the building and so on and so forth. They were mistresses of British officers, everything. But they were also soldiers, probably, I don't know the exact number, probably a fifth. And if the British had just recruited the much larger number of blacks, as you say, who came to their side, they would have won, pure and simple. but they didn't, out of racism largely. So every division had lots of black troops. There were black guerrilla war operations led by Captain Ty in New Jersey and by the Black Dragoons in South Carolina. There were many ways in which black soldiers affected the British Army in North America. They did all the scouting for the British Army and so on, and the scouts also fought. And lots of blacks left, and behind Cornwallis' troops and every other big British military operation, there were thousands of blacks. And in order to get food, because the British hadn't provided for that, they would sack Royalist plantations as well as Patriot or Whig plantations. And the British would steadily recruit more and more of them. So what happened was, unfortunately, that Cornwallis was not a very good guy in any respect. He, in fact, wasn't a very good commander, and he was a rat as a human being. So what he did was drive the blacks between the lines of the Redcoats and the Patriots, with the French behind the Redcoats on the sea, so which is why he couldn't escape. So the result of it was that most of the blacks who'd been following the British had to make their way and try to escape, and a lot of them probably didn't. And it's a very sad story.
You mentioned Colonel Ty from New Jersey, which I found one of the most fascinating stories, period, of the American War of Independence.
Ty was originally named Titus and was a slave to a Quaker, John Corliss, in Shrewsbury, New Jersey. And in 1775, Ty answered the proclamation of Governor Dunmore that I mentioned before. It was actually officially delivered in November 1775, that he would free all blacks and Native Americans and indentured servants who came to the British side and fought the rebels. And he went and fought with Dunmore.
In Virginia?
In Virginia. And Dunmore won the first couple of battles, and half his troops were the Royal Ethiopian Regiment with the slogan, "Liberty to Slaves," sewn into their uniforms. But although he was in many ways quite a brilliant strategist, he was not a good military commander. And having won an early battle, he was defeated at the Battle of Great Bridge. Dunmore eventually retreated to New York. And in New York, there was an effort to form guerrilla forces by the Loyalists, not the British High Command. And the Loyalists, among other things, commissioned Ty to lead a guerrilla band in New Jersey. And he recruited a multiracial band, and he killed 10 of the leading and most vicious patriots, that is, the people who cut the throats of the British without a second bullet. And he captured 10 others and took them to Sugar House Prison in New York. And he took everybody by surprise, and nobody knew that he was coming. And this went on for 3 years. So it set a pattern for guerrilla war in New Jersey, which was a very big phenomenon, doing all these kinds of things and getting supplies from New York. And as the war went on, a similar thing happened in South Carolina, inspired by the efforts of Ty. Now, finally, there was a battle in which Ty confronted this patriot, Josiah Huddy, who was in the house with Lucretia Emmons, and she was reloading the guns, and he was running to the windows firing. And they eventually captured him, and on the way back, they were surprised, and there was another battle, and he got shot and supposedly got lockjaw from the wound and died. And ironically, probably to make fun of the British, but actually I think out of a genuine sense that Ty was a very special guy, the Patriot papers ran a series of stories about how the brave Captain Ty was killed, that he was the best commander on the British side and a dangerous enemy. He killed probably half of the Patriot elite in Monmouth, New Jersey.
And that's it for this holiday edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Heather Content.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.